supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Today's show's about self-tracking, and whether we know it or not, we're all doing it probably every day. For example, how about that summer trip you took or you're taking? You counted the mileage on your odometer. Your car told you how many miles a gallon you got. When you returned, you probably got on the scale to see how much weight you might have gained last night. When you were reading your book on your Kindle, you looked at how far along you are. You monitor how many hours a day your kids are doing homework, and on and on. On today's show, we'll talk about the quantified self movement. It's a burgeoning movement that enables us to find out more about ourselves and others than ever before by tracking all manner of data. And we'll spend a good amount of time learning about how this data can help us change our overall approach to good health, to our lives, and we'll hear about some of the downsides of all this data acquisition. My guests are Susanna Fox, Ernest Ramirez, and Heather Patterson. Susanna Fox is the Associate Director of Digital Strategy at Pew Internet and American Life Project. Her research documents the social life of health information, peer-to-peer healthcare, and the role of internet among people living with chronic diseases. And she joins us by ISDN line. Susanna, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Ernesto Ramirez works at the Quantified Self Labs with founder Gary Wolf. He's getting his doctorate in public health and developing the science of persuasive health psychology. He seems to be everybody's go-to guy on the subject. He joined us by phone. Ernesto, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
A little later, we're going to hear from Heather Patterson, a postdoctoral fellow at NYU's Information Law Institute and Department of Media, Culture, and Communications. And as always, we want to hear from you. How do you track things that are personal to you? What do you look at every day or every week, and what does it do to you? And do you see this as helpful or harmful or both? Our number is 888-477-9499. 888-477-9499. Susanna, I've seen self-tracking data as gathered in order to best optimize one's life. Yes?
That's one reason why people do it. They say that if they are tracking something, they say that they've seen a positive impact on their health, that it helps them to then take that data to the doctor if it's something that concerns them, that requires a doctor's advice. It's not just something that they're describing. They actually now have records and notes that they can share.
How would you define it, Susanna?
Well, when we went into the field for this survey, we actually first crowdsourced the questions with people like Ernesto and the community of the Quantified Self movement, as well as just with regular people, and asked people about what they track. And we divided it into three types of tracking. The first is whether someone tracks their weight, their diet, or their exercise routine. That was the biggest group. Then whether that individual tracks any other health indicators like blood pressure, sleep patterns, or headaches. And then what was really crucial is to understand whether people are tracking on behalf of someone else, like the guest that you had at the top of the hour who tracks her child's health indicators or symptoms. You roll all that up into one, and it turns out to be about 7 in 10 American adults.
Ernesto, I've got to tell you, I'm fascinated with the technology. These technologies, as I read, and by the way, I've got to be honest, I had no idea that this was going on when our producer, Jennifer Lynn, said, I've got an idea. My first reaction is, what the hell are you talking about? I just never heard of this stuff. And oh my God, as I got into it and started doing some research, it was fascinating. So I want to just mention a couple of things that I've learned about the technology. So we're not talking about just digital cameras and smartphones and tablets and computers, but we've got wristbands, headbands, patches, digital technology embedded in fabric, measuring bodily function, sensors can be put in toothbrushes and pajamas. These apps are asked to document mood. I mean, what am I missing? What else is out there?
You know, it's almost at the point now where if you can think about tracking it, someone is building a tool or a device or a technology to help people do that in an easier way. You know, the way that we talk about quantified self, especially at the very beginning, you know, this was back in 2007, was that we saw that computing, you know, just the basic processing, the technology, you know, everything that goes into making computers was getting much smaller and getting closer to the body. I mean, we're even at the point now where there are companies working on how can we make small little chips that go on pills so that doctors or physicians or nurses know exactly when people are taking their medication. So, you know, like you were saying, you know, there's technology that encompasses almost every type of wearable device. And now we're even getting to ingestible technology.
When I looked at the quantified self webpage, you know, of course I was amazed at the ways of tracking self, but even more so that the worldwide proliferation of what's called QS, quantified self groups. There's one here in Philadelphia with over 100 people. What's going on here?
So this is a very interesting phenomenon. You know, it started off in 2007 and then in 2008 with one meetup group in the Bay Area. You know, it started by Kevin Kelly and Gary Wolf, two editors at Wired. They said, you know, let's get some people together and let's talk about how people are using technology in their lives to understand themselves. And that blossomed into two meetup groups, one in the Bay Area and then one in New York. And ever since then, we've just seen this kind of exponential rise in people wanting to talk about how they use technology in their own lives to understand themselves at this deeper level. Mm-hmm. And what we found is that contrary to what most people think, that this is kind of just this weird kind of geek thing, you know, a bunch of kind of maybe techno nerds that are just talking about devices, people are sharing some very intimate details about how they get personal meaning out of their personal data. And they're doing it worldwide. You know, we're now at the point where we have over 90 meetups. We're in 30 different countries. It's a pretty fantastic experience.
I want to take something you said, and Suzanne, I want you to respond to it. The idea of what Ernesto said, deeper meaning. Can we get deeper meaning about ourselves through an app?
Well, I think we're at the beginning of a revolution. What Ernesto described in terms of the trajectory of wearable technology is about what we saw back in the year 2000 when we first started tracking internet use. And we've seen multiple revolutions where just the revolution of people having access to the internet at all, and then the access on broadband, and then the access on mobile, and now I love the example of, you know, gosh, ingestible technology, but I also want to bring it back to the reality of most people's lives, and that is that when we have this finding that 69% of American adults track a health indicator for themselves or for someone else, we have this killer follow-up question. Which was actually, I can say it's killer because it came from somebody outside the Pew Research Center. And that is to ask, how do you keep track? And as one of the choices, we said, do you keep track just in your head? Half of self-trackers just keep track in their head. They just have a number or they have a frequency of a symptom. and they don't write it down. One-third say they track the data on paper, and then 1 in 5 say they use some form of technology,
wow,
like an app that you're describing. And it's those people who just keep track in their heads that I think are really the target market for a lot of mainstream, what's going to be mainstream in the future. And they're still seeing an impact. They're seeing less of an impact than the formal trackers, those who use paper and pencil or technology. But even if you just keep track in your head, you're likely to report that tracking has had an impact on your health.
I want to bring on Heather Patterson here. Heather, I hope you're accessible. We weren't going to bring you in until later in the show, but you know, Ernesto and Susanna are talking about pills you can take or food you can eat that can measure things about yourself and your body. And I almost had an anxiety attack thinking that, what about if we're, you know, down the pike, we're eating stuff and we don't know that there's tracking devices on there? And, you know, I never used to be paranoid, but am I being wise here or am I being paranoid?
I think you're being thoughtful, and I think that that's a good thing. Hi, Dan. I'm happy to be here.
Hi.
And, you know, I don't want to be just a naysayer in regards to tracking or the quantified self movement. You know, the research that we're doing here at NYU is showing that there are tremendous benefits potentially to tracking. The people that I'm speaking with are excited about developing greater self-awareness about their exercise habits and their caloric intake. And, you know, at the same time, self-tracking can raise an eyebrow among many academics and people in the privacy community in particular, in part because many individuals who track their health, either now or, as Susanna notes, in the future, will do so by using commercially available self-quantification products. So typically, you know, sensors and smartphone apps now, and in the future, maybe ingestibles. And on the one hand, you know, it's great that people are getting so excited about tracking. They have certainly a real incentive to be very explicit and complete when disclosing lots of very personal information about their health. At the same time, that excitement may get in the way of them being careful in the moment about thinking about who is getting access to this information and how it's being stored, whether it's being stored securely, how it's being used by the companies that collect it, and the extent to which it might be shared with third parties, you know, not just other individuals, but the company's business associates or data brokers or advertisers or even employers or insurance companies. So I wouldn't call you paranoid, but I would call you thoughtful.
I don't know if that's a diplomatic... Well, never mind. But I do have to tell you, I had a conversation this morning with our intern, Anna DiStefano, and she lost her iPhone when she was on vacation. And, you know, she was able to wipe out everything remotely on her phone, but then she got a new one, and somehow she was able to find everything that was on her previous phone, voice messages and all texts. So they're somewhere. She thought it was private, but that's all somewhere. Somebody theoretically has access to all this information.
Well, these days, information is stored in the cloud. You know, it's stored on servers typically owned by the companies who are collecting the data. And that's more common, perhaps, than information being stored on our individual hard drives alone. And, you know, that's one of maybe the advantages of older tracking systems like pencil and paper or the calendar on the refrigerator or even an Excel spreadsheet on your computer. You have control over the information then. But at the same time, some of the benefits of tracking are lost because you can no longer easily integrate that information with information from other apps and and services.
So let's take a step back. I'm really curious about, well, we'll start with you, Susanna. How did you get into this movement? You've referred to yourself as an internet geologist. Interesting.
Thanks. The Pew Research Center has been taking a look at the social impact of the internet and technology since 2000. And what we do is combine national telephone survey research with field work. And I go into patient communities and into the online world looking for patterns in the landscape. That's why I call myself an internet geologist. Mm. And the key there is that I don't make judgments. I don't say one thing is better than the other. I'm like a geologist. I don't judge the rocks. I just tell you what the pattern is. And one of the patterns that started to emerge in the late 2000s, right around 2007, 2008, actually, is that people started talking to me about tracking their symptoms. And very often this was people who had a rare condition or people who had a very serious life-changing diagnosis who knew that it was up to them to really figure out what was going on and to help their clinician figure out what the right mix of medications might be or to try and conduct what they call N of one experiments, mm-hmm. where it's just one person, that individual, who's trying to figure out why they got a good sleep last night or why it is that their baby has a better appetite this week rather than last week. And a lot of people have done that kind of experimentation, but they didn't know what to call it. And now the quantified self movement is calling it something and is becoming more recognized. And so we started tracking it in 2010, only asking people about technology. And then in 2012, we recognized the opportunity to do the first national survey asking all American adults about tracking in general.
Hmm. Ernesto, I know you got into the this whole quantified self issue because of your love for science fiction. So, you know, I read about that, and I'm thinking, you know, I go back to the 1999 movie The Matrix with Keanu Reeves, a movie that I think was brilliant in that the way it blurred the lines between human and computer. Do you think we're headed in that direction? Are we becoming humans in need of computers to tell us how we're doing?
So that's an interesting question, and one we get kind of asked a lot is, you know, are we on this way to becoming what some would call cyborgs, you know, man plus machine? There are some really brilliant academics that I know that would probably argue that we've been man and machine for quite a while, mm-hmm. that we have different levels of what you could probably call cyborgness already happening in the world. The one thing that I think, like, the deeper part of that question is, are we getting to the point where machines are going to kind of dictate our lives, where we maybe give up free will or choice and start letting computing and technology and algorithms kind of tell us what to do based off of this deep, rich personal data? I would say that we probably aren't even close yet. And I would say that one of the things that we really think about within the quantified self is not like how the machines actually tell us what to do, but what they can help us understand. So rather than being kind of maybe a dictatorship where we're giving up or being subservient to what these things know because they're more powerful than us, they can process information faster, they can do these complex, you know, decisions and algorithms, that we're working in partnership with these data gathering capabilities, so they can help us, you know, answer the questions that are most important to us.
And in order to do that, there has to be a larger non-quantified self that knows that this data works for us and that we are in charge. There's got to be a larger self knowing that this is simply data, because we can get data off an app telling us we don't feel well when in fact we do feel well, but it could take us to a doctor. So there's got to
exactly.
be a larger self.
You're exactly right. That data is very powerful, and you know there's a lot of people these days talking about the power of big data. You know, huge, large data sets, longitudinal information on individuals. And the interesting thing is data really is only as powerful as the context that data is collected in. Like you were saying, you know, something might say, "Oh, you're not feeling well." But you know that that data was collected during a specific time where it appears you're not feeling well, but in fact you're feeling perfectly fine because there's some other contextual information that you know. And that contextual information might be very, very hard to capture. You know, there's no technology to capture that information. So I think we can't rely on data all the time. You know, that might seem a little odd to come from someone from the quantified self.
But
we do, like you were saying, kind of, we do have to think about who we are and our place in the world as we look at this data.
Well, this piece of our discussion, we've got to take a break, but this piece of our discussion reminds me of a very old game show called Who Do You Trust? Like I said, we've got to take a short 60-second break. Much more to talk about when we come back. And we're going to hear from a woman who tracks everything about her son's cystic fibrosis. My guests today are Susanna Fox, Ernesto Ramirez, and Heather Patterson. Susanna Fox is with the Pew Internet and American Life Project. Her research documents the social life of health and health information. Ernesto Ramirez works at the Quantified Self Labs with founder Gary Wolf. Heather Patterson is a postdoctoral fellow at NYU's Information Law Institute and Department of Media, Culture, and Communication. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. What elements of yourself or your loved ones do you track? What impact does it have on you and decisions you make about yourself or your loved one? 888-477-9499. Well, like I said, we'll be back in just 60 seconds. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
One in three families is affected by problems caused by drugs or alcohol. The Family Training Program is a service for those concerned about their child, aged 12 to 25, that may be using drugs or drinking. If eligible, you will be invited to sessions with a family specialist to help make positive changes in your life and in the relationship with your child. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More at 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-I-WORRY-2, or online at iamconcerned.org.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. QS, Quantified Self Movement. It's a movement that involves self-tracking of, well, as we heard from one of our guests, Ernesto Ramirez, self-tracking of almost anything, really. Like I said, Ernesto Ramirez is one of my guests. He's with the Quantified Self Lab. Susanna Fox is with Pew, Internet and American Life. And Heather Patterson is an expert on self-tracking and privacy issues. But right now, let's hear from a mother who's been using a self-tracking tool to keep tabs on her son. Erin Moore is a Cincinnati mother of four children. Her son, Drew, has cystic fibrosis. Producer Jennifer Lynn spoke with her.
Tell me about the phrase 66 roses. It's the name of your blog.
That's correct, yes. So in the cystic fibrosis community, there's a story about a woman who had a son who had cystic fibrosis, and one day he heard his mom on the phone with their doctor, and at the end of the phone call, he had thought that she was saying 65 roses. not cystic fibrosis. So oftentimes cystic fibrosis is referred to as 65 roses because it's easier for children to say. And I chose the name for my blog 66 Roses because I like to focus on the hope and the cure. And the 66th rose for us will be the day that we get our cure.
Tell me about your son, Drew.
Drew is 3 years old, and he has a twin sister. He was diagnosed with cystic fibrosis at birth. That kept him in the hospital for about a month right after he was born. Overall, his health has been really good. He is growing well, he is living well, and we are all very happy.
What is your day like caring for him?
When Drew is healthy, we spend probably between 2.5 and 3 hours a day doing different breathing treatments. I have to do a lot of self-management for Drew to make sure that he stays on track. We track all of his signs and symptoms and his medications and his treatments and his calories and his stools and just about everything about him to kind of help us keep on top of everything that's going on so that if something changes in his daily routine, we're able to identify it and intervene before it becomes a big problem.
Tell me about the self-tracking that you guys do.
Well, historically for us, tracking is a pain. It's hard to do. It is not easy to get results out of. And so I was introduced to a gentleman named Ian Eslick from MIT, and he has created a platform called Personal Experiments. And every day I receive a text message that says, you know, what is Drew's weight today? Or how many calories has Drew taken in today? And I text message that back. So it probably takes me less than a minute to input all that data. But it puts it onto a platform that Ian has created where it charts it all. And it calls things out that are out of the normal range for a particular person. It's truly personalized data.
You blog about this and you share your experiences with this platform and how the information has been very useful at home, but also when you make those trips to the doctor or to the ER. Tell us a story about how this is really helping you manage Drew's condition.
A few weeks ago, we were visiting family out of town, and Drew got sick. My experience this time was different in the past than when I've gone to the emergency room because I had data with me this time. So they didn't have to spend a ton of time figuring out how long he's had this increased cough for because I had the data to show it. It was much easier for me to say to a doctor, here's the data, and have them see that I have useful information, and I'm not just an emotional parent not wanting to be admitted to the hospital. And so we worked together to create a game plan for him and his care, and they decided to just monitor him overnight, and it worked. You know, we were able to avoid a two-week hospitalization because I took data into them. In less than 24 hours, he was better. We were discharged from the hospital, and it was really a success story for us.
That was our producer, Jennifer Lynn, speaking with Erin Moore, a mother who is tracking her son Drew's life with cystic fibrosis. You can follow Erin at 66roses.blogspot. Well, Susanna Fox, I want you to weigh in on this. This is certainly an example of how self-tracking or caregiver tracking can really change someone's life. I'll bet you've heard these stories over and over.
I have, and Erin is a great example of how a mom or a dad will really do anything to try and take care of their child. It's now we have data about it. We collected data about family caregivers and have found that they are more likely than other people to tap into almost every information resource that they can find, whether it's online or offline. And that's true of people who are caring for elders as well as people caring for a child with significant health issues.
Yeah, how many self-trackers did you find in your research were caregivers tracking other people's health?
Great question. So it turns out to be one-third of caregivers are tracking a health indicator or symptom for a loved one, and that translates to 12% of U.S. adults.
I was pretty surprised when I looked at your data and saw the breakdown of those who are self-tracking. I looked at race and ethnicity, and there was no significant difference between white, black, and Hispanic. I was quite surprised at that. And even more surprised when I looked at gender, more men than women are tracking.
Yeah, that was, it's I'm, really, really
I'm sorry, I'm
so
sorry.
Glad.
Yeah, more women than men are tracking.
Yeah, it's just barely when we're looking at the differences in gender. And that is something, I'm so glad that you were looking at the detailed tables. And I'm a nerd when it comes to the data and think that it's really important to look at the various groups. It does also skew a bit older. Older adults are more likely to be tracking. And that makes some sense because older adults are more likely to be dealing with health issues, including chronic disease.
I would think they would be less likely to use technology.
And that is also true. So, for example, 71% of American adults age 65 and older are tracking their weight, diet, or exercise routine, but not many are using technology to do so.
I mean, there's an economic issue here too, isn't it? With self-tracking, some of the monitoring equipment can be pretty expensive. Even smartphones are a few hundred dollars.
You're right. You know that at the moment, you know, we're at this kind of nascent stage of self-tracking technology, where they, you know, everything does tend to cost, you know, right around $100 or more. You know, if you're looking at a digital pedometer, it's going to cost you about $60 to $150. But I think what we are seeing is that very quickly, self-tracking and the sensors and the technologies that make up the tools are going to become commodity items that everyone is going to probably have some type of access. You know, what type of access is kind of, you know, we don't know what that might look like in the future, but there is going to be access there. I mean, you just mentioned smartphones, for example. You know, anyone with a smartphone, an Android phone or an iPhone, you know, whether it's something you got for $40 or something you spent, you know, $300 on, a lot of them actually hold the same type of sensors that can be used to track a variety of different things. Or, you know, just like Susanna was mentioning, a lot of people are taking just pen and paper notes for tracking. We've seen people use smartphones just to update personal spreadsheets or take notes in the moment where they're tracking important things.
I speaking of that, Ernesto, you know, I've been struggling with fatigue for a couple of years now, and you know, my nurses and I have been wondering about the quality of my sleep. So in my research here, I figured, you know, I downloaded a sleep app. I figured, low risk, it's $1.99, you know. So, Ernesto, I have no idea how this damn thing works, but, you know, I put it on my pillow next to me. It monitors my sleep. I don't know if it's telling me anything valuable or accurate, but I got to confess, I look forward to seeing it in the morning, you know, just like what happened, not even knowing if it's accurate or not. So what's happening here psychologically?
So I think this is a really interesting thing, is that especially when it comes to sleep, and you know, it's funny you mentioned sleep because we've heard this, or I've heard kind of this kind of anecdote time and time again. Of all the things, you know, it's pretty simple to go, okay, I'll buy a pedometer and I'll measure my steps, but I have a pretty good idea of how many steps or how much physical activity I'm getting. But when it comes to something like sleep, it's a great unknown. You know, it's almost like being able to finally see the invisible, you know, kind of lifting that curtain. And so we see that a lot with a lot of people that are engaging in self-tracking, that these tools and devices that are giving us these little tiny windows into something that was heretofore unknown is actually quite a powerful experience. And I guess, you know, kind of one of the questions I would ask you in your use of this is, you know, what have you found interesting about some of the things you've seen in your sleep? Maybe some different patterns or different things you've done before you've gone to sleep that have changed the data in the morning? Have you seen anything interesting?
What I found that's really mind-boggling is I know it's accurate with knowing when I fall asleep, how long I'm awake before I fall asleep. As far as patterns are concerned, I've got to tell you, I took this data, and I happen to have a buddy who's a pulmonologist and a sleep expert, And my app said I was spending 38% of my time in REM sleep. And he said, well, that's impossible. He said, infants spend 38% of their time in REM sleep. And he says, by the time you're my age, it's about 10-15% a night. And you're not sleeping 38%. And the other thing is the app said REM sleep was deep sleep, and he said that's not necessarily true. So there's a lot it's off with, but I still look at the thing in the morning. I'm still using it. So it's interesting about using this external vehicle, flawed as it is, to be curious about myself, knowing it's not 100% accurate. Just an interesting relationship.
Yeah.
Back to our discussion about who's got the power and the issue with the matrix.
You know,
I'd like to hear Heather Patterson weigh in on this. What are your thoughts about our relationship with the technology?
You know, I've been interviewing users of popular health self-quantification tools for a few months now. And the people that I'm speaking with are also fascinated to track their sleep. They really want to know what's going on when they aren't consciously aware. And something that I'm seeing more and more is that people are struggling with making the decision about whether to believe their own bodies or whether to believe the data that's being collected about them by these tools. So the question is, what happens when we feel that there's a discrepancy between how we feel and how the numbers say that we feel? So, you know, picking up on your sleep example, I spoke with a woman who told me that she stopped using her sleep tracker because the data it generated was always suggesting to her that her sleep was poor, even though she felt relaxed and refreshed when she woke up. Now, it wasn't that she was frustrated with the device and she thought it wasn't any good, and that's why she stopped using it. It's that she doubted herself. When she looked at those numbers, she wondered if maybe she didn't actually feel as good as she thought she did. So the discrepancy between how she was feeling and how the computer told her she was feeling really bothered her, and she stopped tracking.
Well, so this gets to something Gary Wolf, one of the founders of the QS movement, what he said in one of his TED Talks. He said, these tools are changing our sense of self in the world. And boy, that can be good news or bad news.
I think that's right. I mean, so I'm speaking in particular with people who are wearing smart pedometers, who are working very hard to try to reach particular fitness goals, for example, 10,000 steps in a day. And they tell me that they engage in all sorts of behaviors that they feel secretly are, you know, weird and crazy. And they'll use these kind of negative words to describe their own behavior. You know, I've spoken with a woman who runs in place while she blow dries her hair and brushes her teeth. I've talked to someone who does jumping jacks while he watches TV. I've spoken with several people who walk around the interior perimeter of their house or their apartment at 11:30 at night in order to reach a particular activity goal by midnight. They want to see that number roll over on their device or on their app. Now, I think it's great that they're doing these things, you know, to improve their health and their fitness, but the fact that they kind of laugh about it and they feel a little embarrassed is also seeming to suggest that they feel a little bit controlled or manipulated by
right.
the devices. And I've had some people tell me as well that they feel that they're being overly self-involved, as though this much time into tracking oneself is some sort of an admission of narcissism. I don't think this about them, but
I am going to stop you there. I'm going to pick that up after our break because that's exactly what I want to talk about hypochondriasis and narcissism and self-absorption and all of those themes. We're talking about quantitative self today, a self-tracking movement that's really burgeoning and caught on all over the world. And we've become aware that all of us, almost all of us anyway, are self-trackers. We track a variety of things that we do. We're talking with Susanna Fox, Ernesto Ramirez, and Heather Patterson. Patterson's a postdoctoral fellow at NYU's Information Law Institute and Department of Media, Culture, and Communications. Ramirez works with the Quantified Self Labs with founder Gary Wolf, and Susanna Fox is an associate director of digital strategy at the Pew Internet American Life Project. Our number is 888-477-9499. Tell us how you quantify yourself and if it's changed you or your perception. 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
Do you feel the need to check and recheck constantly? Are you a prisoner of certain rituals and compulsions? Keystone Clinical Studies in Norristown is conducting a research study of an investigational medication for treating obsessive-compulsive disorder, or OCD. If you're between 18 and 65 and have been diagnosed with OCD, you may be eligible to participate. 610-277-8073, 610-277-8073, or keystoneclinicalstudies.com. Keystone Clinical Studies supports WHYY.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Welcome back to Voices in the Family. We're talking about quantifying our lives, quantifying our health, and I guess the rest of our lives. We're talking with Heather Patterson, Ernesto Ramirez, and Susanna Fox. And we've got Elizabeth on the line, ready to join our conversation. Hello, Elizabeth. How are you?
Hello, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I'll give you a very simple example. I was in the reserves for quite a few years, and every year we would have an annual physical fitness exam, and we would be timed on how long it took us to run 2 miles. So in the very early part of my training, I went out and I purchased a stopwatch so that I would know how well I was doing during that 2 mile run.
Huh.
And that is my comment.
Huh. That's interesting. So you prefer to track yourself. Heather?
I chose to track myself, yes.
Yeah. Heather?
Yes.
Heather, any thoughts about Elizabeth's comments? Preferring to track herself rather than be tracked. It gets to the conversation we've been having about.
I think it's.
Go on.
I think it's a decision that individuals make, whether they want to be in charge of kind of monitoring their own activities and exerting control over their lives in this way, or whether they are comfortable outsourcing that to a third party. You know, and in the latter situation, you might see that people derive benefits from being able to integrate, say, in this case, the amount of time it takes you to run a particular distance with other information about yourself, you know, how well you slept the night before and how well you were eating that week, and to compare yourself to others, to be able to look online and participate in a kind of gamification of health, you know, to see that there are X number of people in front of you in line, you know, faster than you running this race or slower than you running this race. And some people derive great benefits from that kind, that sense of community. Other people prefer not to. They really, even if they use a modern pedometer, a smart pedometer, they might prefer to set all of their privacy settings to private and to not have any friends on that on that service.
So you
they're really just interested in keeping track of themselves.
You actually have to set your settings to private?
You do. It's one of the kind of tricky things about some of these commercial services is that the settings are often not private by default. I mean, if you think about it, self-quantification is, as it's becoming more recognized, it's also becoming a big business. And these companies can make money in different ways. They can sell hardware. They can offer premium services that users can subscribe to on an annual basis, or they can be free. The business model often will dictate to some extent how much information they want to extract from their users,
wow,
or how much information they'll want to incentivize their users to provide.
You actually had a pretty frightening example of the use of information on Fitbit, which was tracking the frequency of sexual activity, and I don't know why people need an app to remember their sexual activity, but that's for another show. Anyway, Google was indexing these pages and found users were actually broadcasting their sexual activities to the public.
This is kind of a classic example. This happened in 2011. A technologist discovered that about 200 Fitbit users were indeed inadvertently broadcasting their sex lives online. They were logging their sexual activities themselves on the website, and in some cases were being quite detailed, assigning dates and times and labels for degrees of effort given, sometimes even naming specific activities. And what they didn't realize is that this particular setting at that time was public by default, and so it was showing up in Google search results. Now, to its credit, Fitbit seemed startled by those disclosures. A spokesperson said that she didn't expect users to log intimate activity, and they worked very quickly to change the default privacy settings to flip that over into private. And now their privacy settings are some mixture of public and private. So, for example, the number of steps you take in a day, the distance you walk, that's public information by default, but some of the more personal information is indeed private by default.
Well, I wonder, and I'll turn to you, Susanna, you know, people tracking their own sexual activity and tracking all of this data, are we creating a culture of narcissists here?
Oh, my. I'm not sure that we have data to say yes or no on that question. I will add that when we asked people if they share their notes with anyone, it was 1/3 of trackers share their notes with a clinician or a spouse or a loved one or, you know, a coach. And so fully 2/3 of people are keeping these notes private. This is just for themselves. And sometimes I've thought about it in terms of life is a puzzle. And sometimes we don't have all the pieces. And self-tracking can help you define some of the pieces that you're missing.
I'm still not done with this narcissism issue. And I want to turn to you, Ernesto, because, you know, we can wind up thinking that every little thing about us is not only important, but that it's interesting, too. Now, when Gary Wolfe gave his TED Talk, his opening comments was that he scored low on the narcissism scale. Now, with all due respect, Ernesto, to your boss, I think you got to be a little narcissistic to measure yourself on a narcissism scale. With all due respect.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. No, completely understand. One of the reasons, just kind of a side note, one of the reasons he put that up there was because this is something that we hear all the time and time again. It's usually, most of the time, coming from people outside looking in, people that aren't doing a lot of self-tracking, people that or maybe very new, that haven't maybe gone to one of these meetups or one of our conferences, that kind of
have this little bit of, because it does look like narcissism. It looks like people that are just kind of very self-obsessed. And, you know, as you were talking with Heather and Suzanne, I was trying to think back, like, this is not a new thing. And I'm venture to guess that this conversation probably happened a long, long time ago when mirrors were getting put into mass production. Why would you want to have a mirror in your house to look at yourself all the time? Like, how self-obsessed could you possibly be?
Well, and I also
know that that's just a normal.
I also wondered about people in psychoanalysis every day for year after year after year and begin to think that everything they think and feel is important, relevant, and interesting.
It is true. I think, you know, some of these things, you know, there is probably, just like anything else in the world, you know, you can go probably too far down the path and track too many things or become a little bit obsessed with it or think that every piece of data is important. But I think it's on the average, you know, if you look at the people that are really engaging with this, from wonderful people like we heard from Erin, who's helping track, you know, her son's medical records, to a lot of people that are doing this because, you know, we've even heard people like, for instance, people with type 1 diabetes, self-tracking is a life or death phenomenon, all the way down to people that are just, you know, either like yourself, tracking your sleep, that most people are doing it because they have questions about themselves that they'd like to answer, that time and time again, they want to know kind of what is the reality of their life. Am I getting good sleep? Am I getting enough physical activity? Am I eating the right food?
Well, I've got to cut you off here, Ernesto, because we're out of time. But I have to tell all three of you, this has just been fascinating to me. I'm kind of a newbie at understanding the big picture, and I really appreciate it. It's been terribly interesting. So thanks all three of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
My guests have been Susanna Fox, Ernesto Ramirez, and Heather Patterson. If you want to comment on today's show, we're whyy.org/voices at drdangottlieb.com and follow us on Twitter with Voices in the Fam. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Charlie Kyer. Thank you, Charlie. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Anna DiStefano is our summer intern. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn produced this show. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends. This is